Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how's the post-conference bird doing?
The bird's still flying. Yeah, it took me about, I think, a week maybe to kind of come down from the clouds after the Reformation Conference. Man, that was a blast. So many great speakers, just great time hanging out with people, some old friends, making new friends. Had a lot of fun recording our 100th podcast, which hopefully everybody's listened to by now. So anyway, yeah, it was great. It was great. Success in every single way.
Yeah, man. Yeah. A whole mess of people sold out. 500 people on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. It was, can't ask for better than that.
No, you sure can't.
So we diverted while we were there. So for some reason, people were like, I don't want to hear these guys live or whatever. We're now picking it back up where we left it before the conference.
Yeah, we did a little fast forward. We skipped all the way to Isaiah, and then we jumped from there to Luke chapter 4, just to kind of bring together the Old and the New Testament, since Eric was with us on that particular podcast. We will put it in reverse, and we will go all the way back to Exodus once more. And you know, we're at a pretty critical phase today, Dan. It's a stopping point for all the tabernacle stuff that we've been talking about over the last few chapters. And for the next three chapters, Exodus 32, 33, and 34, we're kind of right in the middle of a mess again. It's the story of the golden calf and the fallout from that, and trying to kind of pick up the pieces and figure out what in the world is going to happen next. So a lot of good stuff to talk about with chapter 32 and the next couple chapters. It's sort of our it's the in between section here. So you had 25 through 31 that were the instructions for the making of the tabernacle. You know, all the miscellaneous stuff that we talked about there. And then 32, 34 is this interval, and then we're going to pick it back up. Except we're going to go pretty fast through that last part of Exodus. 35 through 40 is where we go back to the tabernacle. But a lot of that is quite honestly just kind of repeating what we've already covered in 25 through 31. Just instead of telling us how the tabernacle is to be made, those chapters tell us how it was made. So we'll get through 25 through 31 at a pretty fast clip. But here we are. In chapter 32. So we're gonna see what happens while Moses is up on the mountain while he and God have been having this conversation over the last 40 days.
Well, I think this text is probably gonna be a struggle. It's one of those weird texts that we just cannot relate to and has no application to how we operate.
You know, it's gonna be a stretch because you know, the Israelites struggle a lot with idolatry, which we in our elevated sanctity no longer struggle with.
Exactly.
Being fully devoted heart and soul and mind to God 24/7.
Yes, the ease of the Christian life in the West has eliminated all idolatry from Christendom.
Yeah, it's just monotheism is just rampant now. It's a sign of the times. We'll do what we can, you know. We'll try and be creative here and see how possibly Exodus 32 and the golden calf has some relevance to our lives today.
All right, I'm interested to see how you do it.
Yeah. Well, I'll put my thinking cap on, so we'll see how it goes. I want to spend a little bit of time with the first verse because there's actually quite a bit packed in here, and we will begin to unpack it and see what we can come up with. So the previous chapter ends with God giving Moses the two tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. So that's the way the chapter ends. And the way the next chapter is going to begin is not with the finger of God, but with the hands of man. and what they're going to be up to is no good. So here's how, let me just read the first verse and then we'll talk about it. Now, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him." So if those listening were at the conference and you heard David Zoll speak, which by the way was a fantastic presentation. It always is. Zoll always delivers the goods, but I was making mental notes as he spoke because I knew this was coming up, and this chapter was coming up. And David actually referred once in his presentation to the episode of the golden calf. And what he said, I thought was very insightful. So he refers to the fact, David does, that Moses is up on the mountain, and he's gone for a long time, 40 days. People don't know what's happened to him. And the point that David made with this story is that that people abhor a religious vacuum. So the vacuum, the vacancy that was left was Moses being gone. He had been the spokesman for God to them. He was their leader. He was the one they looked to deliver to them the words of God. And so in his vacancy, when he's absent in this vacuum, they need some kind of religion. And so if nature abhors a vacuum, then people abhor a vacuum of religion. So what they did is they came up basically with their own. Now, David went on to talk about how people are, our problem is not so much today that people aren't religious enough, it's that they are too religious. So we have the religion of parenting, we have the religion of exercise, we have the religion of marriage, we have the religion of work, whatever it is, people are turning to that in order to have some kind of higher, deeper meaning in life, something that they can understand themselves by, something they can live for, something that they can get some sort of meaningful reason for their existence from. You know, people do that for various reasons. So in this particular vacuum that's left by the absence of Moses, what they do is they're going to create a God who will go before them.
There's a lot of people will make the statement, I'm sure you've heard it before, that they're spiritual, not religious, right? Mm-hmm. Which always bothers me because and my response is always the same, that I'm pretty dang religious but not very spiritual. Which I think is the case with me. I'm a really religious person. And to Dave's point, which is really brilliant, nothing wrong with being religious about the right thing. The point though is that we're hyper religious and about all the wrong things. So we like make everything into a religion. All of that then, of course, is idolatry. Like every time we fill a religious vacuum with some religion that we made up, we are committed idolatry. Of course, if you want to be religious about God, I mean, Jesus extols religion, true religion. Jesus is about as religious as they come, right? But and tells you what true religion is. But there's only one way to be religious and not idolatrous, and every other way of being religious is idolatry. And we see that, we do that. We reject God constantly, and then fill the void that we've created with any manner of things, any number of different golden calves that could be anything.
Yeah, I was reading this week a quote by Robert Capon. I think it's from The Astonished Heart. And he speaks to this as well. I put it on my Facebook page. It's a great quote, and it relates exactly to what we're talking about. So he writes, "The world is by no means averse to religion. In fact, it is devoted to it with a passion. It will buy any recipe for salvation as long as that formula leaves the responsibility for cooking up salvation firmly in human hands. The world is drowning in religion, but it is scared out of its wits by any mention of the grace that takes the world home gratis. I thought that was a great quote that speaks directly to this. The world is by no means averse to religion. In fact, before we started recording, Dan and I were talking about the author James Smith and some of his books. And one of the points that he makes is he doesn't call us homo sapiens. He calls us something like homo liturgicus, which just means we're liturgical people, or another way of saying it, we are worshiping people. That's who we are. I mean, that's who God has made us to be. And so you don't have anyone who's irreligious, who is opposed to religion. That's like being opposed to being human. Humans are worshiping creatures. It's a question of who or what we're going to be worshiping. It doesn't matter if we're a monotheist or an atheist or an agnostic or whatever it is. There's always going to be some object of our worship, even if it's the person in the mirror. But someone or something is going to be the object of our devotion, of our love, our trust, of our religion.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a non-worshipper.
No, yeah, there's all, every activity in our lives in one way or another is oriented toward that worship. It's just a question of whether it is oriented in the right direction or not. So that was Israel's issue. They were religious people just like we are. And they had been dependent upon Moses, and he delays. You know, I was thinking about this. That is a temptation. You know, he says he delayed when the people saw Moses delayed to come down from the mountain. In other words, he wasn't acting on their timetable. They thought he was gone too long. They wanted things to happen more quickly. They wanted things to take place in the order and of the time that they wanted them to take place. You know, this happens a lot. In our lives, you know, if things aren't going the way we want them to go, in fact, maybe they're going the exact opposite direction, or, you know, we're praying, or we're hoping and nothing seems to change. And a day goes by and a week goes by and a month or year or years go by. And very often the temptation is to finally decide that we need to take matters into our own hands and look elsewhere for help. And we saw this in the biblical story. We saw this with Abraham and Sarah, right? God promised them that they would have a child, but they got tired of waiting. And so in comes Hagar. We'll take matters into our own hands or into our own bed, and we'll take care of the matter in a way that's much more expeditious than the way God's taking care of things. And that's really what the people did here. Moses delayed, and so they acted. And they acted according to their own presuppositions of how things should be. So they assembled about Aaron. Now I'm reading from my English Bible, New American Standard. I found one translation, and I can't remember which one it was, but I found really one translation that I think accurately reflects what the Hebrew is implying here. Because it's not, the Hebrew implies not just the people assembled about Aaron, like they, you know, just kind of gathered in a crowd around him and said, "Hey, we want a God." Really, the Hebrew that they assembled against Aaron, it's the same structure, grammatical structures used elsewhere in the Pentateuch, about like when the people are angry with Moses and Aaron in the desert and they gather together against Moses and Aaron. So there's a negativity and a threat that is suggested about this. Not that I'm letting Aaron off the hook. I'm not by any means. But when they gather around him, probably in some sort of very pushy, possibly threatening way, in such a way that they are going to insist on him doing what they want him to do. So here's what they want him to do. "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him." And we talked before about the Hebrew word for God, not the personal name Yahweh. This is Elohim in the Hebrew. And Elohim is one of those kind of strange words. It all depends on the context as to how you translate it. Grammatically, Elohim is a plural. So we would translate it gods. But when Elohim is used in reference to the true God, we translate it not as plural, of course, but as singular. We translate it just as God and not gods. So there's a little bit of ambiguity here, as because you really have to kind of dive into what the people's intentions might be. When they say, come make us a God, do they really mean Elohim in the sense of one God? Do they mean Elohim in the sense of multiple gods? Or what are they suggesting? I think we'll get to that as a story unfolds. I just want to make that point now, that there's it's a little bit of uncertainty about how we should translate this. Probably all the English translations rendered it with a little g, make us a god. So they don't want the God. They want a God who will basically take the place of Moses in a way, but who also is going to take the place of he of whom Moses is the representative and the spokesman. So here we are, Dan. This is us. Let's say we're Aaron in this situation. So Big Brother is up on the mountain, and we're supposed to be in charge down here, right? While he's gone, and the people come to us. So what are our options? What are we going to do?
Well, I think one of the things you have to remember is that I think that we can think about like, all right, so there's Aaron, and then like these five dudes come up to him, and like, you know, he caves in. It's not like that. Like, there's a lot of people, man. I mean, this isn't just like, well, you know, the church council really wanted to do this thing, so I couldn't say no to all 10 of them. Like, this is a lot of people, and so I mean, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, it's kind of a threatening mass. You know, I get the picture here that they've encircled Aaron. He's got nowhere to go, and they're telling him in very very clear language what they expect of him. Right. So the pressure's on. There's no doubt about that. So. What are his options? Well, I guess one option is to say no, right?
Sure. Probably the better thing to do at that point.
Probably the better thing to do.
They might they might kill him.
Yeah.
I don't
which
know.
Which is very likely. Yeah. I mean, at many other times they wanted to stone Moses and Aaron. So that's not just kind of a possible scenario. It becomes a very much a probable scenario later on. Which of course was the right thing to do. In fact, he could remind them of first words or the last recorded words that they said. I meant to bring that up earlier. I read this in one of my commentaries. I hadn't actually noticed it myself. The commentator pointed it out that recorded words before these are back in last recorded words of Israel. Are back all the way in chapter 24. So 24 verse 7, covenant is read. The people say, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. All right? So that's Israel speaking. And there are no more recorded words until chapter 32, when Israel speaks again, and the first thing they say is, come, make us a God who will go before us. So they go from... you know, this pledge of absolute fidelity to a demand for Aaron to give in to their unfaithful desires.
Yeah. So it's all this we will do, and the very next words are trying to obliterate the first commandment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, which is where all sin begins. If we fear, love, and trust in God above all things, we will not break any of the other commandments. If we only have that one God, truly have just that one God, then we won't take his name in vain or kill or covet or anything else. But if we don't, then everything else falls to pieces. It's the domino effect of the commandments. So Aaron basically has two choices. It's a yes or a no. And as we see in the story, he says yes. In fact, not only does he say yes, but he actually comes up quite rapidly with a plan of action. So he says to them, tear off the gold rings which are in your ears, which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. Now, I've always thought there's a little bit of an implicit irony in here, because they're taking out their golden earrings, and they're so the idol comes from that which was around their ears, when they should have been using those ears to give heed to the words that God had spoken to them in the covenant. But instead they're deaf to his words, and they take these emblems from their ears and they use them to make the golden calf, which we'll get to in just a second. You know, this isn't the only time something like this happens in the scriptures. I'd forgotten about this until this morning, and I was looking at the book of Judges chapter 8. You know, Gideon does the same thing. That, you know, it's one of the things about the Bible. You know, they always say you should learn from your mistakes, but that doesn't happen very often in the scriptures. In fact, people seem to repeat the same errors over and over and over again. And that's what happens in the book of Judges when Gideon has everyone throw their golden rings on this blanket, and he uses it to fashion this idolatrous ephod. So he was following the bad example of Aaron when he does that.
All the sin in the Bible is fairly redundant. It's just the same stuff over and over again.
Yeah, that's the thing about sin. There's really no creativity to it. I mean, there is. We talk about original sin, but sin is really never original in one sense. I mean, it's always just a repeat. One generation doing what the generation before it did it, you know, maybe in a slightly different way, but basically you've got the same 10 commandments being broken in the same way over and over and over. It's either one generation mimicking another generation, or one person doing over and over what they've done before.
Yeah, I mean, when Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun, that includes sin.
Yeah.
No, I mean, nobody like does something like I've never even heard of that.
Yeah, nobody's ever done anything quite like that. Yeah, well, actually, they have lots of times. So here we have them tearing off the golden rings which are in their ears, and they're bringing them to Aaron, and he took this from their hand. It says, and he fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf, probably. He has some sort of wooden mold that he put this gold around, and then that became the golden calf. And they said, so this is the people speaking here, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now this this raises a very interesting question, which I think is worth talking about for a minute. So what is actually going on here? There's I think two or possibly three different scenarios. I mean, like, what are the people thinking? So if you put yourself in their situation, I mean, they know that by this time it's patently clear that Yahweh is the one who brought them up out of the land of Egypt. He sent Moses. And through Moses, he brought them out of Egypt. He led them through the Red Sea. He's brought them to Mount Sinai. They saw him come down in the smoke and the fire. They heard him speak the Ten Commandments. They said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So it's not as if there's some sort of vague notion of some unknown divinity up in the sky who's kind of orchestrating all of this. I mean, it's clear that Yahweh has done this. He's the one who brought them up out of the land of Egypt. So these people are not stupid. I mean, they know what's happened to them. So what are they saying when they reply after the calf is made? This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. Now, of course, we could simply say that they have completely switched their allegiance. And instead of now worshiping Yahweh, they are worshiping this image. That's one possibility. The second possibility, and the one that I think is accurate in this case, is that what they want is some sort of kind of a compromise, if you will, what we might call today's syncretism. It's this idea of a combination combination of two things. So they want to still worship Yahweh, the God who brought them up out of the land of Egypt. But what they want to do now is worship him under the emblem of the golden calf. So the golden calf is perceived to be the image or the icon of Yahweh, or possibly that he is invisibly present on top of this pedestal of the golden calf. A common Near Eastern thing to do. You'd have some kind of bull or calf or ox, the pedestal upon which the god would sit. So maybe that's what they were thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the insidious ways we are idolatrous, is that the sneakiest form of idolatry is the idolatry, is the worship of a god with the same name as the true god. I mean, so there's no shortage of people worshiping the wrong Jesus. I mean, you could go up to somebody and say, describe your God to me, and they would maybe tell you all these things about him, and then you're like, oh, well, which God is that? And they'd be like, oh, it's Jesus. And you're like, oh, weird, because I don't recognize that at all. It's odd, because I also worship Jesus, but I would have described that very differently. So that's the sneaky, I mean, that's just, I mean, all the cults do this, and I mean, if you go ask a Mormon, what's your God like? They're going to tell you all kinds of weird stuff. And then when you're like, so what God is that? They're like, well, the God of the Bible. You're like, oh. So I think that, like, this is the sneakiest form of idolatry that the devil tricks us into. Is like, oh, yeah, like, you could totally name him Yahweh. You could totally name your Savior Jesus, as long as it's not him. I don't care what you call it. I don't care what you give it credit for. Like, just as long as it's an idol and not the real thing.
Yeah, that really is the way idolatry works. I suppose it's always been that way, but certainly today that's the way idolatry works. I mean, I don't know of any true polytheists, people who believe in the existence of multiple gods, but there's lots of idolaters out there. All of us, in fact, me included, where we like to fashion God in the image that we want God to be in, which ends up being nothing more than a reflection of ourselves. So we think this way, and therefore God must think this way. We act this way, and therefore we think God must act this way. And so we kind of concoct this hollow divinity, if you will, and we pour into him all our own thoughts and desires and wishes and dreams and assumptions and presuppositions and everything. And that's what we think God is. And we might call that God Jesus, or we might call it just God, or whatever our chosen name might be, but it ends up being nothing more than a hollow divinity that's an idol infused with their own ideas. And that's what Israel is doing here. I mean, they want to continue saying this is Yahweh. In fact, the very next verse, Aaron says, tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh. So whatever the people were thinking, certainly Aaron assumes that they haven't changed gods. He thinks that they're still worshiping Yahweh. But here's the thing. You don't get to worship God in the way that you see fit. You don't get to worship him under the image of golden calf. You don't get to think of him or to worship him according to the way that you think he should be, because that's doing nothing more than replacing God's word with our own words and God's will with our own will, which is what idolatry always is. So we can say Jesus, 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 Jesus all day long, But if the Jesus whom we claim to worship is not the Jesus of the scriptures, then he's nothing more than a golden calf. And we end up using God's name in vain because we apply the name Jesus to something which is nothing more than our own self-made idol, which is what Israel was doing at the foot of Mount Sinai.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we read this and we're sort of, you're sort of shocked because they're worshiping, you know, a legit idol. It's a golden animal, which is like when you think of an idol is what you think of. And so we're like, I would never try to worship God wrapped in the golden image of an animal. And it's like, yeah, no, probably not. You probably wouldn't do that, but you might worship God wrapped in stars and stripes or something like that.
Never.
Might do that.
Not in America. That would never happen.
Might do that. You worship God wrapped in all kinds of things he hasn't told you to wrap himself in.
Yeah, I know we have listeners in other countries, Australia and Germany and elsewhere. I'm wondering if they have the same experience there. But the civic religion of America, I mean, that's a super popular form of idolatry, right?
Oh, dude, nationalism is just an idolatry on steroids.
Yeah, I mean, it has its own worship, it has its own rituals, it has its own sacred spaces, it has its own icons like the flag.
We bring that stuff into the house of God.
Yeah, you talk about confusion taking place big time. Yeah, so yeah, nationalism is a super popular form of religion with some people, and that's basically the civic religion. We all, you know, claim to believe we speak of one nation under God. Well, which God are we talking about? It's kind of the national God, right? I mean, in some ways, we're no different now than the ancients were. Every nation had its own God, and so you had kind of a national God. Well, that's what nationalism is. It's really the deification of our political desires as they are expressed in all sorts of rituals and symbols and sacred spaces, and this idea of us being the kind of the workers out of our own salvation according to our acting like civilians and pledging fidelity to the nation, everything else that easily devolves into a form of idolatry.
Yeah, I mean, I think here we even make this thing a Trinitarian. I think in a lot of ways for a lot of people, I mean, I see this all the time. I think faith, family, and freedom have replaced Father, Son, and Holy Spirit for a great many people. Like that's the triune God. Is this sort of what we would claim is sort of this, you know, Christian or Judeo-Christian, you know, foundation and ethic, but the way you hear it spoken of is faith, family, and freedom. That's what we're about, and it's even Trinitarian in nature. We're like these are the things we worship.
It just goes to show that that the most popular forms of idolatry are always good things in and of themselves.
Right.
You know, nothing wrong with faith. Nothing wrong with freedom. Certainly nothing wrong with family. There's nothing wrong with money. There's nothing wrong with children. With exercise, with work. I mean, all of these in and of themselves are good things. And that those good things are always, almost always, that toward which we gravitate when we want to come up with our own religion. I think partly because these are things that we have quite a bit of control over. And if there's anything we want in our religion, it's something that we can control. That we can, you know, kind of pull the strings on and manipulate so that we feel good about ourselves. We have a little bit of control over our salvation in this particular religion. So, yeah, I mean, that's a sinister part of this, is that Satan really doesn't throw something that is just, you know, some kind of rank evil before us and say, worship this. Because it's too obvious. I mean, he's an angel of light. He masquerades, so he's sneaky in the way that he comes at us. And so he puts something good in our path, and he says, hey, make a religion out of this. And we all too often do exactly that.
Yeah.
So here's Israel. They've come up with this golden calf. I'm sure it was quite pretty. And, you know, gold, nice. Nothing wrong with gold. Nothing wrong with a calf. But you put those two together, and now you have idolatry. But Aaron tries to save the day as much as he can. Aaron sees this, and so he builds an altar. This isn't just going to be kind of an image. There's going to be an altar. And he says, tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh. So they have it. It says the next day they get up early and they have a sacrifice. They offer burnt offerings. They bring peace offerings. And if you remember, I mentioned this before, peace offerings are offerings that are unique in that part goes in the altar, but most comes back to the worshiper to have a sacred barbecue. And that's what happens next. It says the people sat down to eat and to drink. So the whole burnt offerings were completely consumed on the altar before this calf / Yahweh. And then the peace offerings were offered. They go back to the people. They have their cookout and they're eating and they're drinking. It says they rose up to play. Now, people have talked about this play quite a bit as to what exactly is designated by this. And it's too ambiguous actually to say. The Hebrew verb tisahak that's used here, Isaac, and if you remember, Isaac means laughter, to laugh, but it can also mean to caress, like in a sexually suggestive sort of way. So whatever was going on with this play, some people have suggested that there's some sort of kind of ritual sexual activity that's going on. That might be reading too much into it. But whatever's going on, they're certainly having a lot of fun. I mean, this is kind of a celebration. You've got everybody being happy. So nobody would have looked on from the outside and seen this and thought, oh, what a depressing sight. So from the outside, everything looked great. They've got worship going on. They had meals going on. They had happiness and celebration going on, which just goes to show that when you look at things from the outside, it doesn't necessarily mean that what's going on the inside is in accordance with God's will. The people may have been having a great time, but everything that they were doing there was a stench that was rising farther and farther up the mountain, and it's about to get into the nostrils of God. We'll see how he reacts in the next few verses, but we'll have to save those for later because we are just about at the end of our 40 minutes.
Ah man, yeah, I was hoping we were going to get to Moses' response to this whole thing, but that will have to wait until next week.
We will save that for next week. Moses, in many ways, steps into the shoes of Christ here. He becomes very much of a mediator in the verses that come after this.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. So we have set up the idolatry. Moses is about to walk down and get an eye full of this mess. He's not going to think that this is a good, happy time. He's not going to jump right in and participate. I've got thoughts about Moses and what he does, but it'll have to be next week. Chad, we'll see you then.
See you then. Thanks.